5 times in the Earth's past, cataclysmic events nearly extinguished most species. These phenomena are called mass extinctions. Scientists have recently determined the causes of 2 of them, an asteroid striking the Earth and the eruption of a supervolcano.
A new documentary, Mass Extinction, Life at the Brink, which premieres this Sunday on the Smithsonian Channel, chronicles those discoveries and carries a warning. Scientists are increasingly concerned that humans could be responsible for a future mass extinction.
Evolutionary biologist Sean B. Carroll is the film's executive producer, and he also runs a lab at UW-Madison. That's where WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz reached him. He explained why looking so far back is critical to the Earth's future.
The reason to look back in time is that mass extinctions are extraordinary events. Biologists and geologists have known about them for a long time. And the question everyone would ask is, you know, what does it take to kill off the majority of life on the planet? Shouldn't we know about those things? And really, until about 1980, we didn't have a good clue about what would cause the majority of species to disappear. And then some of the greatest detective work I know about started to unfold. And what's particularly great about geology is that when events happen in the Earth, those events are recorded in rocks, and scientists have to figure out a way to sort of unlock those memories that are inside rocks. And by doing that, over the last 30 years or so, they've been able to figure out the causes of 2 mass extinctions. And while those causes are different and are fairly exotic to our experience of enormous asteroid or huge volcanic eruptions, they do tell us a really simple message, and that is when environmental change is great enough and fast enough and on a global scale, life is really in trouble. And that's a bit of a hauntingly familiar message to what we're getting from looking at the state of the planet today.
So let's just dip back to the time of the dinosaurs and what, in brief, scientists have discovered.
Well, it was a hint from a chemical in the rocks that was not expected, a chemical called iridium, that clued researchers that something had impacted from outer space, because iridium is rich in things like asteroids but rare on the Earth. But it took 10 or 11 years to find the impact site, which is in the Yucatan in Mexico. And until that impact site was found, there was a lot of doubt of whether or not a large asteroid had struck the Earth. Once that impact site was found and people understood the scope of the impact and what that would do in terms of blasting debris out of the atmosphere and having it raining back down on the planet, and hundreds of places around the globe had been found where that debris had rained back down, we started to develop a picture of what kind of cataclysmic event that asteroid impact was and how it destroyed habitat. 50 or 60% of plant species went extinct. And if you think about it, it's pretty easy to knock off, you know, 10 or 20,000 large dinosaurs. It's really hard to make a plant go extinct because, of course, they can grow back from seeds and things like that. So when plants go extinct, I think that's telling us something, that the conditions on the planet were really, really tough. And so the whole food chain was compromised both on land and in the ocean. So going back 66 million years gives us a sense of, well, you know, what does it take? Well, it takes something that interferes with the normal functioning of the way food chains work and the way ecosystems work, and like a domino effect, mass extinction can unfold.
So talk about the KT boundary. I mean, give it a little sense of what was found on either side of that boundary.
The KT boundary is a term geologists use for a boundary that's found all over the world, formed by this short period in Earth's history where there had been an impact. Some of the impact debris was deposited, and in the oceans there was sort of a dead zone there. And by studying the life that existed below that layer before the impact, and the life that existed after that layer, after the impact, you get a sense of it's really 2 different worlds. Below that layer, there are dinosaurs and all sorts of other creatures that roamed in times before 66 million years ago. And above that layer, there are no dinosaurs. And as you go further above and come to more recent times, you find the large animals are all mammals. So there was really a dramatic change in the world between what existed before the impact and after the impact. You know, you get sort of a snapshot of 2 different worlds, and that's what scientists have been doing for the last 30 years.
One could look at that and say, how cool, that was so long ago, I'd like one of those fossils. I mean, you know, how do you bring that front and center to consider the impacts we're having on our environment and habitats?
Well, you need to figure out, well, how could something, it was, you know, the asteroid was 6 miles wide and it hit the Yucatan and drilled a hole about 120 miles wide. But, you know, the Earth is huge. I mean, this is literally, it's almost like hitting a barn with a BB. But it hit with enormous power, unleashed massive amounts of energy, and blew enormous amounts of debris into and out of the atmosphere that circled the globe. And when it rained back down, it essentially rained down, you know, hot rock, setting off wildfires and things like this. And so what we understand from looking at, for example, the ocean record is that tiny little creatures, things at the base of the food chain, were snuffed out. And on land, you know, plants were wiped out. And that's telling you that by blasting stuff into the air that blocked out the sun for some period of time, that rapid change was devastating to life on Earth. And it took a long time, and you can see this in the fossil record, it took a long time for life on Earth to recover to where diversity was somewhere, you know, up close to what it was before the impact, on the order of millions of years. And that's just one example. But if we go back about 250 million years, there was another mass extinction.
That one's called the Great Dying?
The Great Dying. That's probably 90% of plant and animal species disappearing. That, we now know with high confidence from really recent work, was caused by massive volcanic eruptions underneath present-day Siberia. And that just pumped massive amounts of climate-changing gases up into the atmosphere, including massive amounts of carbon dioxide. And we can tell from various traces in rocks that that had dramatic changes on temperatures across the world, both on land and in the ocean. In a relatively short amount of time, probably on the order of tens of thousands of years, the majority of life on the planet went extinct. And what's worrisome to scientists today is that we know that the magnitude of temperature change that happened 250 million years ago is in the realm of what we're facing in the next century or two based on projections of global warming. So we know that, you know, an 8, 10, 12-degree shift in average temperature across the globe is a massive thing that really disrupts the web of life. And so by looking into the past, we understand the cataclysmic effects that environmental change has had in the past. We're trying to arm ourselves with the knowledge of, you know, understanding what we may be facing in the future. And this is why a lot of my colleagues are really anxious, is that the more we've understood about past mass extinctions, even if they were caused by different triggers like asteroids or volcanoes, they had their effect through a common means, which was unleashing these climate-changing gases and changing the course of life across the Earth.
One of the warning signs of today's situation that is pointed out in your documentary is what's going on in Yellowstone National Park.
Right. We thought it was it'd be valuable to go look at places that are, you know, essentially some of the best protected places on Earth, but they're not immune now to climate change. So first, you know, to be really clear, up until now, the extinction crisis we face with a large percentage of species at risk has really come about through a host of reasons short of climate change. The way we've used habitat for our own uses, or we've harvested creatures, or taken down forests and things like this. Now, so we'd have an extinction crisis even without climate change. But now with climate change, you're adding another complicating factor. And in places like Yellowstone, which has been a refuge for some of the mammals that almost went extinct in North America, things like the grizzly bear or the bison, there's changes taking place in Yellowstone that are directly traceable to climate change. And they're the kind of things that surprise us. You wouldn't necessarily imagine this connection, but it tells you a little bit about how much life is interconnected. And the most, to our eye, the obvious changes in Yellowstone are that very high elevations, the whitebark pine that lives at high elevations, is being decimated. So you're just seeing these large swaths of dead trees on the ranges in Yellowstone. And the reason for that is that they've been attacked by beetles, by pine beetles. And those pine beetles are normal residents of Yellowstone. But what's happened is the winters are not as severe as they used to be, which used to kill off a lot of the beetle larvae. And as things are a little bit warmer, the beetles are going to higher elevations, and the trees at high elevations don't have any natural resistance to the beetles. And so the trees are getting attacked, and they are killed rather quickly. And the reason why that's important is that those trees produce really important food for all sorts of things, squirrels, birds, but also, as it turns out, grizzly bears, who gorge themselves on the seeds of the pine cones of those white bark pines before they hibernate. And so, you know, there's a chain of events. A little bit warmer in Yellowstone, trees are suffering from beetle infestation, and it turns out lots of things are dependent upon those trees. And those are the kind of connections that you know, biologists don't even have a full grasp of, but they're seeing these things happening, and they're happening faster than we expected. The biologists that I've spoken to who were worried about this 8 or 10 years ago are shocked by how quickly things have moved in places like Yellowstone. And when things are happening faster than scientists even feared, you know, their anxiety is going up. But for the moment, what we can do and what individuals can do, and I think this is the hardest thing when bringing up any of these, you know, major issues like this, is what individuals can do is work to help protect things that matter to them locally. Local lakes, those near the seashore, local bays, those involved with parks, any preserve, anything we can do to strengthen the amount of land and water that is being protected is really buys us time. And then over the decades, we're going to have to deal with some of the root causes of the stresses that we're putting on the earth. And that's, of course, going to take lots of countries at least paddling in the same direction.
For a long, long time, humans were part of nature. Now, at least some of us consider ourselves masters of nature, which is thought-provoking at a minimum.
It's an enormous change for the planet. If you go back, you know, to the early times of our species, even, you know, 10, 12,000 years ago, humans were a relatively not that abundant mammal. You know, our population has exploded. It hit 1 billion for the first time around 1800 and took another 100 years to go to 2 billion. But in the last 100 years, has gone up to 7.5 billion. And, you know, we consume a lot. We're a large mammal, given our sort of average body weight. And we consume a lot of resources. So, you know, in terms of the balance of things on the planet, there's a lot less resources, space, food, et cetera, available to everything else living on the planet. This one species, our species, has really commanded a lot of things. And we might say, well, you know, that's just the way it is. It's just that a lot of the rest of the things on the planet serve us in purifying our water or feeding us, you know, keeping our shorelines from falling into the ocean. And so even if we just take a very sort of utilitarian view of the rest of nature, these changes are going to affect the systems that support humanity. And that's probably enough reason for most people to really care. If fish populations crash further, there's going to be a lot less food to be harvested from the ocean, and a large amount of the human population depends upon things that they can get from the ocean. We're going to see water shortages in parts of the world that are probably going to really strain, you know, geopolitical situations. So we're going to feel the impacts of this in lots of ways. It's not merely about the moral or aesthetic value that we place on giraffes or leopards or whatever it might be. We're going to feel these impacts because nature provides enormous amounts of services, you know, to humanity.
I'm hearing from what you're telling me, Sean, that the gravity that you see in all this has influenced the evolution of your own career.
Yeah, I think I'll put it really simply. You know, as a 10-year-old, you know, I loved nature programs and I loved going out flipping over logs and things like this, and I decided to become a biologist. And the time since I was that kid and had become a biologist, half of the world's wild populations have vanished. You know, that, I sort of feel like that's on my watch. And it's sort of, I think this is, you know, a crisis for, you know, even professional biologists to look around and say, you know, we've made such tremendous understanding in terms of advances in understanding how nature works and life works and tremendous medical advances. But at the same time, we've really degraded the world we're living in. And I felt that I couldn't just sit in my office and either complain or worry about it. I had to figure out something that I could do to contribute.
UW-Madison biologist Sean Carroll is the executive producer of the new film Mass Extinction, Life at the Brink. It premieres on the Smithsonian Channel this Sunday, November 30th.
Carroll spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz, and you'll find more about the film and about Carroll at WUWM.com.